In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Climate change is the ultimate heads I win, tails you lose marketing scheme. If the earth warms, they can say, see, we need to do something. But if the earth cools, they can say, see, our efforts are working. But the whole thing reminds me of a Gilligan's Island episode. The professor had set up a measuring stick out in the lagoon, and after carefully recording the daily water levels, he came to the conclusion that the island was sinking. Soon he had the entire island in an uproar as they packed everything up and moved to higher ground. That is, until they found out that Gilligan had been using the stick for his lobster traps and kept moving the stick further and further from shore to deeper water. Likewise, the so-called science of global warming is ripe with fraud, including fudging the temperature readings when the warming stopped. What's really scary, though, is how close we came to pulling a Gilligan's Island. We were led to the brink of disaster by our so-called leaders. We nearly committed to spending hundreds of billions of dollars on an utter fraud because climate change scientists kept moving the stick. Just imagine where we'd be if Hillary had won the presidency. So on today's show, it's all about the lunacy of the left. First up, Dr. Tim Ball to talk about the Paris Accord and the wider implications of withdrawing from it. And then James Herson of Headline Hollywood, who is himself an attorney, to talk about the James Comey testimony, as well as Kathy Griffin and Hollywood's leftist lurch deeper and deeper into the lagoon. I'd like to welcome Dr. Tim Ball back to the show. He is a retired professor from the University of Winnipeg, who is one of the leading critics of the so-called global warming consensus. Dr. Tim, it's great to have you.
Well, thanks again for the opportunity.
Well, we absolutely cannot not talk about President Trump's decision to pull us out of the Paris Accord. This was a big win for us here on the I Spy Radio Show and everyone who has been fighting the leftist so-called green movement. Aside from the fact that the Paris Accord did nothing or would do nothing that would actually lower temperatures, it was and has been and continues to be a massive fraud, a huge transfer of public funds nearly exclusively to people and organizations on the left that were committed to promoting the fraud of climate change. So how much money did this just take from the green movement?
Oh, it pretty well removed everything. Particularly the American funding through the United Nations, because when Maurice Strong set up this whole global warming fiasco, a deliberate deception, he said, I'm going to go to the United Nations where I can get all the money I want and not be accountable to anybody. Well, suddenly now what Trump has said is, no, you're going to be accountable to us. That's American dollars you're spending, and we're funding most of it, and we're getting the worst end of the deal, and we're getting virtually no say in it. I happen to think, by the way, that that with his success of pulling out of this, he'll pull out of other sections of the United Nations as well. In fact, it might just be the undoing of the United Nations.
Wow.
I remember back in the 1980s when I was looking at this, and there was a study came out that if you just remove first-class airfare from the UN, this is the 1980s, first-class airfare, you'd save $480 million a year.
Wow.
I mean, it's the biggest, richest club in the world,
yeah.
And it's just unbelievable. But so the pulling out of the Americans pulling out of this Paris Agreement essentially means the end of the climate research and the IPCC. The whole thing will collapse now.
Well, this will certainly save the United States hundreds of billions of dollars over the,
yep.
the lifetime of that agreement had it gone through. European leaders and others are vowing to continue. I saw Michael Bloomberg said that he's going to donate up to $15 million to this. Do you think this will continue and basically limp along? Will they spend their own money? I know leftists hate to do that, but do you think that there's a chance that they will?
No, they won't. There's just hand waving. But here's the thing. They admitted that both with the Kyoto Protocol and the Green Climate Fund, which of course is what the Paris Agreement was designed to implement, that the effect it would have on the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere were of virtually no consequence at all.
Yes.
And with the Kyoto Protocol, I think it was like a 0.001 degree cooling of the Earth over 70 years. And then they came back and said, oh, well, it's the first step. It's just a beginning. Yeah, okay, just a beginning. We got our tax foot in the door, and we'll just keep raising the taxes from here on out. The Paris Agreement and the Green Fund was part of that. But I think it's important to the listeners to understand what was going on here. And this began back in 2010. That was the year at which the Conference of the Parties, which is the group that determine how much money they're going to spend on the climate change issue and how much political attention it's going to get, they met in Durban to replace the Kyoto Protocol. Now, the Kyoto Protocol, of course, was the great scheme that the industrialized nations had caused global warming by their burning of fossil fuels, and they'd have to pay for those sins. And that money that would be taken from those developed nations, mostly from the U.S., would then be transferred to the nations that had so-called suffered at the effect of this. And it literally was a transfer of wealth thing. And, of course, it was going to be done through a carbon tax orchestrated by the International Monetary Fund. Well, in 2009, they were going to approve the Kyoto Protocol. And then the emails were leaked from the Climatic Research Unit at East Anglia, and the Conference of the Parties, the COP group, had the problem that their regulation said you must act on the science that the IPCC give you. Well, now this science is shown to be corrupt, and the whole thing collapsed. But there's a more important part than that, because when the Kyoto Protocol, they were trying to get it approved through the U.S. Senate, and the fact that America was such a big factor in this, they wanted the U.S. Senate to approve it, and it had to be the Senate because it was a treaty. The Kyoto Protocol was a treaty. The Paris Agreement wasn't a treaty, deliberately so. It was an agreement, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But the Kyoto Protocol was a treaty. They knew, Clinton and the gang knew, they could not get this thing through the Senate. And that the politicians did their usual weasel game. They didn't want to have to vote on the Kyoto Protocol. They didn't want to be seen as being opposed to saving the planet, being green. So they passed the Byrd-Hagel resolution. And in this Byrd-Hagel resolution, they said, should we vote on the Kyoto Protocol? Right? And they voted 95 to nothing not to vote on the Kyoto Protocol.
Mm.
And so the whole thing went out the window. And you go and read that Byrd-Hagel resolution, and it's only about a page and a half, and all of it is, this is going to cost jobs, this is going to hurt the economy, we just simply can't afford this,
yeah, and yet
because of the rewards in it.
And ironically, despite the fact that they knew that it was going to cost jobs, cost the American taxpayer tens of billions of dollars, they still tried to go ahead and push this through. All right, everyone stay with us. We're going to take a little break here, come back with Dr. Tim Ball talking more about the Paris Accord, and also we'll be talking about the impact of coal. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show, keeping an eye on big government. And today we're talking about the lunacy of the left. Right now we're talking with Dr. Tim Ball about the Paris Accord and all of that nonsense. And then later on we'll be joined by James Herson talking about some of the lunacy coming out of the left-leaning Hollywood crowd. So we were talking about the Paris Accord there, and you were talking especially about the Byrd-Hagel Agreement. Why don't you go ahead and pick things up from there?
Yeah, well, of course, once that went through and there was a 95 to nothing vote against not to vote on the Kyoto Protocol, that triggered a whole problem for them, because without the U.S. being involved, the original Kyoto Protocol said that you had to have 50% of the countries that produced 50% of the world's CO2. Then the only country left that was large enough to be involved that they could try and inveigle into ratifying the Kyoto Protocol was Russia. And Putin, in fact, he had his economic advisor, Ilarionov, going around the world saying, this is rubbish. This is scientific rubbish. I'm not signing this. And then all of a sudden, and I watched Ilarionov over in Vancouver give the presentation. It was very good. And then he went back to Russia, and all of a sudden Putin says, I'm signing it. And Ilarionov said, what the hell is going on here? And he resigned. Well, Putin came right out and said, the only reason I'm signing it is because they've told me, they being the European countries and promoters of the IPCC, they said, and the Kyoto Protocol, they said, if you don't sign it, we will not support your application to the World Trade Organization. And Putin decided that was economically more important to him than any breaking of his agreement on the Kyoto thing.
So basically, he was blackmailed into it.
Well, more than basically, he came right out and said, I'm being blackmailed. He didn't beat around the bush. Putin doesn't beat around the bush. I mean, you can not believe him. But he tells you what he thinks and why he's doing something, and whether it's true or not is for you to decide. But he came right out and said, "I'm doing it because they won't let me into the world trade without doing it." Mm-hmm. But anyway, a year after the leaks from the EU and the Copenhagen collapse, as I said, they went to Durban. They created the Green Climate Fund, and this is a fund countries that are producing the CO2, according to the original list of countries, Annex 23, as it was called, in the Kyoto Protocol, which did not include China, did not include India, did not include Russia, that those countries had to put in $100 billion a year into this fund, which was held in a bank in South Korea, if you can imagine. And from that, then these other countries that had suffered because of what these industrialized nations, that is the United States, had done, were going to get paid. And one of the things that got missed in the mainstream media, before the Paris Agreement, China came right out and said, hey, we were promised $2 billion out of this green fund. We want our money.
Yeah.
And so, of course, this is what Trump looked at. So the Paris Agreement, now Obama is now caught. He can't call it a treaty because that would require Senate approval. He knows he won't get that. So he calls it an agreement. And then the other countries who didn't want any part of this saw that weakness and said, okay, look, we're all world leaders together, and we'll help each other out, and that's the way they play the game, as you can see in Washington all the time. And that goes on at the world level. You know, they all meet and agree to meet again and pat each other on the back and all the rest of it, but nothing ever changes.
No,
it
never does. And speaking of changes, though, setting aside the massive amount of money schemes that this was going to be, was there anything in the Paris Accords that would have actually affected climate in any way?
Well, there were requirements to reduce levels of CO2 production back to most of it was back to 1992, but that only applied to those countries that 23 countries of the Annex A, and so this was the problem certain countries, and this is what Trump was saying, we're required to reduce back to 1992 levels. We can't open another coal plant, but there's no restrictions on Russia, India, or China, who are now the biggest producers of CO2. In fact, as you know, China's opening two coal plants every 5 days, and there's no requirement for them to reduce their production. So what you've done is that in an already uneven playing field, Paris Agreement made it even worse.
Well, and that seems to be the real problem with their argument there, is that they claim that burning coal was reducing a lot of CO2. CO2 was raising the temperature of the Earth, and yet there was going to be more CO2 produced at the end of their end of this. So how could this then lower temperatures?
Well, it couldn't. It couldn't. And that's the whole point. So, of course, this is why a lot of the other countries, wasn't just the U.S. that was opposed to the Paris Agreement. There were other countries that didn't want to do it, but they were not putting that much money into it, and they weren't big enough to do what America had to do. This is why it needed Trump's leadership to pull the plug on this thing.
Yeah.
Now, you watch. There'll be countries fleeing it like mad. And one of the things that Kerry had to do was when these countries were saying, look, we're not going to sign this agreement. It's not fair. China gets away with burning all the coal they want, and we've got to reduce. This is not fair. But they still agreed to the Paris Agreement. And the reason they did it was because Kerry and with Obama made it non-binding. The thing was meaningless anyway.
Well, it wasn't meaningless to the organizations and scientists that were due to make $100 billion every year. Let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming back, we'll be talking about coal. Is it the boogeyman that the left makes it out to be? And welcome back. We're talking today to Dr. Tim Ball, a retired professor from the University of Winnipeg. He is a Canadian geographer and historical climatologist, very well known for his public opposition to the so-called scientific consensus and the global warming controversies. Speaking of consensus, did you happen to see that article by James Dellingpole the other day? It was on Breitbart, and he was actually talking about another article that said nearly, I think it was 60 studies and 80 different graphs all prove that there is no scientific consensus as far as the global warming is concerned. Did you happen to catch that?
Yes, I did. And of course, just the use of the word consensus in the scientific context shows you that it's political.
Yes, yeah.
Because science is not about consensus. There's that lovely comment by Einstein. He said, I can have 500 facts prove me right. One fact proves me wrong, and that's the end of it.
Yes, exactly right. Well, it's not about consensus. You know, and we've been talking about the Paris Accord, and I was doing some interviews shortly after that had happened, and I had said that climate science is not science. Because two characteristics of the scientific method are that science is testable and repeatable. Am I wrong in that assertion that does not apply to climate science?
Well, it totally doesn't apply. And in fact, Richard Lindzen over 30 years ago said the consensus was reached before the research had even begun.
Mm.
Because the way the scientific method it's set out by Popper was that, and Thomas Kuhn in his on scientific revolutions, is that you create a hypothesis, and then which is based on assumptions. So you say, well, if this true and that true and that true, then this is what will happen. Other scientists immediately become, and they are all skeptics, immediately start attacking it and testing it. And if it holds up to the attacks of those other scientists, the skeptics, then it can become a theory or a law. I mean, Newton didn't start out with the laws of gravity. He started out with the theories of gravity.
Hmm.
And over time, it was tested. But that never happened. With the climate change issue, they assumed that if CO2 increase, they said if CO2 increases, the temperature will increase, and CO2 will increase because of human activities. Therefore, that's guaranteed. Therefore, we predict that global warming will occur. Well, immediately we started asking questions about it, but we're isolated as skeptics, when in fact we were doing our jobs as scientists. So that's the proper scientific method.
I think you and I should test this. I think we should apply for several billion dollars of funding, and we'll release several hundred billion cubic feet of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and we'll see if the temperature goes up.
I love that. I'm so game for that I once genuinely applied to the Canadian government for $1 million grant because I wanted to study what it would be like to win the lottery.
Oh boy!
I didn't get the money.
Well, something tells me we're not going to get our funding for our carbon dioxide release study either. So, you know, one of the things that we do have here in this country is an abundance of coal. Coal is blamed for. I mean, it is the boogeyman of everything on the left. But in the language of business and markets, that abundance of coal, that's a competitive advantage. It's cheap for us. It's easy to access. Versus a country that has to import coal, therefore making it more expensive. In a normal world, we'd be looking to expand the use of coal, find new ways to improve its use, making it cleaner to mine, easier to mine, I mean, making it cleaner to burn, even more efficient, thus giving people even more reasons to buy it from us. So in terms of cleaner coal and with various scrubbers and whatnot, it's already cleaner to burn than it was, you know, several decades ago. What's the current research and development around coal?
Well, the coal, of course, deposits of coal. You want to get one of the great ironies of the world is that you've got India with huge iron ore deposits but very little coal, and China with huge coal deposits and very little iron ore. If they ever get together, we're in trouble. Mm. But people, first of all, to your question about where is the frontier of the research, Bob Murray, who's been one of the people that's been vilified. He's owned coal companies. His family have owned coal companies. And he, with two other coal producers, built at their own cost, and it was over $30 million, a clean-burning coal plant in North Dakota. The government never, ever spoke to them or investigated or looked at the technology. But the ability to burn coal clean has been around for a long time. For example, right in the middle of the campus of William and Mary College, and I think it's Pennsylvania, but they have a coal burning plant that's been there for 50 years. The students don't even know it's there. So the ability to burn coal clean has been around forever. The problem is that no politician would vote to bring in the clean burning coal technology because it increases the cost of the electricity. And so they've avoided the issue. They just, what they do, they get into politics, stay around long enough so that they don't have to deal with any real issues, and they get their pension and head down the road. So the technology to do it has been around forever, and it wouldn't take much. And now, of course, it's going to be difficult because natural gas in a marketplace as Trump wants makes the cost of putting scrubbers on and burning the coal clean even more uncompetitive.
Yeah, we've only got about a minute here with you. In terms of the research and development, are they researching any other uses for coal beyond burning it?
Well, there have been one of the things that went on during the war, and countries like South Africa were in the forefront of this, was countries that, like Germany, they didn't have oil, so they got into processes of producing oil from coal. But of course, the problem with all of these things, like with alternate energies, is that you have to do proper, accurate cost benefit analysis. And unless you do those properly, you just create a completely distorted market. And that's the situation we're in right now.
Ironically, that's exactly what we see with the green movement, where we have funded that so much. A lot of those wouldn't exist if we weren't publicly funding those. All right, everyone stay with us. We're going to wrap things up with Tim Ball after this. And welcome back. We're talking to Dr. Tim Ball. He's a retired professor from the University of Winnipeg. He is a historical climatologist, best known for his public opposition to the so-called scientific consensus in the global warming controversy. And so just to kind of wrap things up, I'd like you to look ahead a little bit. In February, it was announced that the Trump administration would investigate the false science behind climate change. This was an article in the New American. Any idea how that's going?
He did mention that, and Scott Pruitt's been saying that. Part of the difficulty with that is, of course, they're effectively acknowledging that CO2 is the problem. My argument is that we're better to do nothing. Unless you're going to do a complete study of climate change, natural causes and human causes, and of course that's how they narrowed the focus down to only looking at human causes, unless you do across the board climate change studies, you're better not to even bother. And in fact, I would go even further. What I would do is I would say that weather offices should only have one job, and that is to collect data. And then that data should be farmed out to private forecasters. We're wasting millions and millions of dollars on forecasts that simply don't work. So there's an old Yorkshire saying in England, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah. I had mentioned that James Dellenpole article, and of course we'll put that up on icebyradio.com if people want to find that. But he mentioned that review of 58 scientific papers that dispute the whole notion of consensus that global warming is happening.
Yeah.
So it does seem like more and more skeptics are starting to speak up, and they're winning in doing so. If you were to make a prediction, say a year from now, will climate change be in a death spiral, or do you think that they will have found a way to ramp things up again?
No, I think it'll be in a death spiral. Once you pull the government funding from it, there's no incentive for private companies. And I mean, I know for in chairing commissions on companies that require weather data, what they do is they'll build the weather stations they need for their own data. They don't even bother with the government data. And so the thing will just simply die a death. Pull the government funding, and that's all that's been maintaining it. And it's like Elon Musk pulled out of the Trump's cabinet team.
Yeah, good riddance.
Well, he 82% of his income came from government funding.
Yeah.
Pull that, and he's nothing. He's nobody. His Tesla dies down the highway. And so you pull the funding, and it'll be beyond the death spiral. It'll be over.
There was a recent appearance on the Weather Channel it was actually on CNN. He was the founder of the Weather Channel. And within that interview, he said $2.5 billion was spent on global warming research, but only on condition that they support the global warming hypothesis. I mean, this can't be good for global warming alarmists. They're about to lose $2.5 billion on funding just in that research level. I mean, that's a tremendous amount of money. Just to put that in perspective, that is nearly $1 billion more than what Apple spent on advertising in that same year. I mean, this is nothing but sheer marketing money.
Oh, of course. But the actual amount that the U.S. government have been spending is in Joanne Nova, the Australian researcher, did a whole book on this.
Yes.
And she put the figure at $70 billion a year.
Yes. Yeah. I'm not sure where he got that number, because I know that in fiscal year 2014, the White House, they funded $22.2 billion. So I'm not quite sure what that number was that he was citing or where he got that from.
No, I don't know either. But, I mean, John Coleman has been an outspoken person against it. But, when Joan Holdren was in the White House, he was certainly putting a whole deal of money towards it.
Yeah.
But it's like with the subsidies to the alternate energies. There are so many levels and so many parts of the whole process. I'm not sure you could even do a good cost-benefit analysis anymore.
No, I don't think you could either. You know, still looking ahead, what is a bit concerning is the language Trump used when he withdrew, that he might look to get back into the Paris Accord if it could be made into a better deal for the U.S. Does that concern you that Trump might try to jump back into it?
No, I don't think so. I think that he's well enough aware, and I know you've spoken with Myron E. Bell and other people that have been advising him. He knows well enough that there is no substance behind it and no need for it, and that the climate will change naturally. What you've got to do is to have a flexible and adaptable economy to deal with those climate changes.
Yeah, well, I think if it comes down to a matter of it being negotiating a better deal, there's nothing that could make it a better deal in its present form.
No.
It's always about putting the U.S. in a weaker position and about funding the left, and that will always be a recipe for disaster.
Exactly. And people need to remember, you know, we went from wood burning and carbon to when we were producing steel in England, and the Industrial Revolution began in the west of England, because as that one wood resource disappeared, the coal was on the surface, and the coal mines in the Forest of Dean, it triggered the Industrial Revolution. And since then, the burning of coal has saved hundreds of millions of lives and improve the quality of billions of lives of people on the planet.
Yes.
And of course, that's what India is arguing. India is saying, hey, we've got people starving to death. Why won't you let us burn coal to improve our standards like you've already done for yourselves?
That's right. And I think they're absolutely right on that, is that we should be supporting that. So, Dr. Tim, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you again for the opportunity. There's so many things that we need to bring some common sense to, and you guys do a good job of it.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that very much. And coming up next, James Herson of Headline Hollywood, James Comey, Kathy Griffin, and a whole lot more lunacy straight out of Hollywood. We're going to continue our look at the insanity of the left, but we're going to look now to that epicenter of insanity, Hollywood. The latest example of this is Kathy Griffin posing with the decapitated and bloody head of Donald Trump. I'd like to welcome James Herson of Headline Hollywood. He is a New York Times bestselling author of Tales from the Left Coast, True Stories of Hollywood Stars and Their Outrageous Politics. But most of you probably know him as a frequent guest on Fox News, but also on I Spy Radio. James, it's always good to talk to you.
Hey, it's great to be with you on a slow news day.
Yeah, really?
Actually, no such thing anymore.
Yeah, well, it seems that that's for sure. So, you know, you're a lawyer. You've got a law degree. What are your thoughts on the whole Comey affair? The Comey Show, I guess, is how we ought to say it.
Well, yeah, the Comey Show. Yeah, because, well, people in Hollywood are jealous. Because, you know, this has better ratings than anything they can produce. It was on every station. It was in the sports bars. I mean, people were getting up early on the East Coast. Out here on the West Coast, they had it. They were serving, you know, chicken fingers and beer and popcorn so that people could watch Comey. From a legal point of view, this is a huge, disappointing loss for the left. They're like
yes.
Wile E. Coyote. You know, they had their bomb. The Comey bomb was going to explode and end the Trump administration. CNN had a clock, you know, where there's 48 hours and 22 minutes till the Comey testimony, Wolf Blitzer announced. And Comey comes out, and based on what he said, even if you accept them all as true, which I don't, but if you accept them all as true, there was no crime. There was no impeachable offense. If anything, any criminal question marks are over the head of Loretta Lynch and Comey himself.
Yes.
More so than Donald Trump. So, you know, because look at what he did in his testimony. He confirmed that Trump said that it would be a great idea to continue the Russian investigation. Don't terminate it, but keep it going. That's what Trump said.
Hmm.
He confirmed that Trump said, use the word hope that the Flynn investigation would end, Michael Flynn, General Michael Flynn would end, which is exactly what Trump said publicly. He hoped it would end because Flynn's a good guy. He confirmed that Trump was essentially asking him, meaning Comey, to make public that Trump was not being personally investigated, and he confirmed that Trump wasn't. Being that he told him three times, just as Trump had said, that he assured Trump that he was not under investigation. And this is the part that really gets me. Comey said, well, he's never written down notes from meetings with people until Trump. Well, why? Well, he said, quote, the nature of the person, I was honestly concerned he might lie. Wait a second, this is a guy, he didn't take notes with Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, really.
The person that William Sapphire called a congenital liar?
Yeah.
But he does with Donald Trump. Often, Comey, it's disappointing to me. The FBI is the greatest law enforcement organization in the world, and the head of this great law enforcement organization that deals with evidence, proof, facts, is talking about his feeling. You know, I could hear the song being sung in the background,
yeah.
You know, feelings, nothing more than feelings, because that's what he was saying all the time. It was my gut.
Well, and on the other side of that, too, what he was saying was that Trump lied about the integrity of the FBI. And yet here you've got the director of the FBI leaking information. He admitted it under oath that he was leaking information. So I don't see that as a lie by Trump. If anything, he proved what Trump was saying.
Absolutely. And he proved a good reason to fire him.
Yes.
An FBI director that leaks is an FBI director that not only should be fired, should be investigated himself.
Yes.
And now we have a situation. First of all, I want to say, as a lawyer, the idea of a special counsel on this Russiagate issue is ludicrous. There's no evidence of a crime at all. And the special counsel was triggered, according to Comey, by his leaking. He intended it. He intended to manipulate a special counsel into being appointed through his leaking. It worked. And it was because of spineless people like Rod Rosenstein who caved and decided to have a counsel in search of a crime. Not only that, they pick Mueller, Bob Mueller, who is joined at the hip, that's the word that's used in the Beltway, with Comey. Mm. They're best buds. They work together in the Justice Department, the FBI. They offered to resign together. Mueller and Comey met before he testified. I mean, this is a conflict of interest. Now Comey has admitted he's a leaker. Comey's a key witness in any case. Mueller should be out of there.
Yes.
There's more of a case for Mueller to recuse himself than Sessions, who did.
Well,
this is a very strange time.
Exactly. And you can't say that there was obviously a problem with Bill Clinton meeting with the DOJ head then, Loretta Lynch, and there not be a conflict here when with James Comey and Mueller.
That's right. And of course, Comey threw Loretta Lynch under the bus, and good for him, explaining that Loretta Lynch, unlike Trump, who used the word hope and never gave him an order to alter an investigative process, Loretta Lynch did. Loretta Lynch ordered him to change his terminology and the way he presented things to the American people to conform with Democratic talking points. By the way, that's called obstruction of justice.
Yes. Yeah.
And so Loretta Lynch has, out of this testimony, a real legal liability. Comey himself has real legal liability, and President Trump does not. That's not what the Democrats wanted.
No, absolutely not. I guess the only question coming out of this whole Comey day is whether or not Kathy Griffin will appear in a photo op holding James Comey's head. So,
well, you know what? That depends on whether the Democrats decide that he's the bad Comey or the good Comey.
Yes.
Because remember, you know, he's switched. You know, they were calling for his head after he released that letter in October before the election about Anthony Weiner's server.
Yes.
And they were praising him up and down when he let Hillary Clinton go in that ridiculous press conference where he presented an indictment and then said, oh, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, humor's all about timing, and she had the wrong head and wrong time, apparently. We will talk about Kathy Griffin after this with James Hurston. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now with James Hurston. You know him from Fox News and a whole bunch of other places. He's also the best-selling author of Tales from the Left Coast, True Stories of the Hollywood Stars and Their Outrageous Politics. And we'll link that book and his other books up there as well on iSpyRadio.com. Just look for the store page. And so we were talking about Kathy Griffin there. I mean, this is just, I think it even shocked some people on the left. I mean, she is not somebody that's a huge talent. She's really made a name for herself simply through outlandish comic routines. I mean, did the reaction by the left that this was out of control behavior for her, did that reaction surprise you at all that the people on the left were even critical of her?
A little bit, because there's most of the people on the left are, their judgment is clouded by their visceral hatred of Trump. But I have to say, it's gratifying to know that after Bill Maher makes an incest joke about the president, when Stephen Colbert makes a sexual innuendo joke about Vladimir Putin and having intimate relations with President Trump, that there still is some line that can be crossed. It's kind of gratifying to know, because even Anderson Cooper, Chelsea Clinton, eventually Senator Al Franken, I hate saying that, but Senator Al Franken even canceled his appearance with her. I think they realized that, not only because it's multi-layered. I mean, it's in horrible taste to joke about the death of a president, period.
Yes.
No matter who the president is, and good conservatives have condemned that, no matter who the president was. That's not funny, and the Secret Service doesn't think so, and that's why they'll pay a visit to someone who jokes about that. And then, in addition, she overlaid it with this image that is an ISIS image.
Yes.
ISIS is the enemy of the Western world, a vicious, evil, demonic group, and you don't joke about that. So combining those two and doing it in a premeditated way with a staff, with a photographer, with makeup artists, with all of Kathy Griffin's entourage cheering her on, it was it showed something wrong with her standards and her morals. And I know her personally, and she has standards and morals, but her judgment has been clouded again. She is an activist. She has been her social media accounts drip with hatred.
Oh yeah,
for President Trump. And it's she's got to pay a price for that, and I think the free market has given her just punishment, and then she punished herself.
Oh, that was just
embarrassing. By not staying away from the public with that goofy press conference with Lisa Bloom, Gloria Allred's daughter, standing at her side. She tried to turn herself into a victim. That was negating her apology.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, you talked about this notion of visceral hatred by the left of Trump, and you see that not just with individual actors, but with production companies as well. Marvel is probably the best example of this that I can think of, where a number of those actors and the director have all come out railing against Trump. Chris Evans was a little bit of a surprise to me how visceral his hatred has gotten. But, I mean, they have gotten so bad that my wife and I, we don't intend to go to their movies anymore, even though that they're, you know, we enjoy their stories. Are we in the minority in this, or are there other signs that they've gone too far and other people are also starting to pull back?
Well, you know, Samuel Goldwyn told filmmakers at the founding of Hollywood, he said, you know, leave messages out of it. He said, if you want to send a message, use a telegram. That's a famous quote. And the conventional wisdom has been that actors are products, or they're at least part of a product, and it is utterly stupid to go out and alienate potentially 63 million people who voted for Trump and believe in the policies, not just the person, but believe in the policies and love the idea of an outsider. And to alienate them is just plain bad business. And you know, I think that there should be, not that the, you know, you call for a boycott, but there should be ramifications, because when somebody taints their brand, you know, I am one of these deplorable people that are really happy about the policies of the Trump administration. And when all of a sudden I hear, I'm a musician, I love music, but if there's a musician that starts getting deeply involved in politics, I mean, I may not want to listen to a Bruce Springsteen song after that, because it's going to invoke images other than just the music. And I think that's normal. And so, you know, in Hollywood, there's a lot of people in the industry, business people, executives, agents, lawyers, who are very upset when these celebrities go out and speak mindlessly about geopolitics, and particularly about Trump.
Yes. Well, actors, you know, that's their business, is to spend their career having somebody else's words come out of their mouth. So I'm not sure that necessarily qualifies them for political activism. But one of the ones that, you know, just to continue the Marvel theme here, we only got about a minute with you. What happened to Robert Downey Jr.? I thought he was supposed to be a conservative.
Well, you know, Robert Downey Jr. Has conservative values. He is someone that discovered his soul when he was in prison. He woke up in a pool of blood, and he decided to change his life. So he does have conservative values, but he's so immersed in the same system and the same bubble of the Hollywood industry. And also, you know, he's been very successful with the Marvel franchise, with Iron Man, and made a ton of money. And so I think that all of that has influenced his thinking, unfortunately.
It is unfortunate.
And he's another one that should not. I mean, he's got a great brand and he's very talented.
Yeah.
He shouldn't damage it like that.
That's exactly right. Don't squander that. James, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, my pleasure. Great to be with you.
Well, that's all of our time for today. We certainly hope that you're at least a little wiser for having joined us. As always, if you'd like more information on today's topics or would like to order our guest books, head to iSpyRadio.com. Like any good research paper, we always have the links up there that helped inform us for today's show, so you can read them for yourself. We also have some of our favorite tweets of the week up there, including a cartoon that pretty much summarizes the entire Comey testimony day. Just a little something to share, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.